Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Elizabeth Crook. We're going to be talking about her latest novel, The Matstone. Elizabeth has published five previous novels, including The Witchway Tree, which is one of my favorites, The Night Journal, which received the Spur Award from Western Writers of America, and Monday, a Kirkus Reviews Best Book of 2014, and winner of the Jesse H. Jones Award from the Texas Institute of Letters. She lives in Austin, Texas with her family. And in 2023, Elizabeth received the prestigious Texas Writers Award from the Texas Book Festival. And Elizabeth, welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you, Hopeton. I am always happy to be here on your show.
So Benjamin Shreve is back, as you know, Witchway Tree, which was my favorite novel of the year it came out. And Benjamin Shreve is just such a down-to-earth character, just this, I don't want to say plotting, but just this sort of do-right, has some flaws, character who's goes unexpectedly on adventure. So in The Witchway Tree, he's helping his sister track down a panther, which disfigured her and killed her mother. In this novel, he is helping Dickie, who, by the way, I love that character, Dickie, quite a humorous character who gets left behind a stagecoach, which has an important one of his bags, which has something that is very dear and important to him. And Dickie recruits him to catch up with the stagecoach because he has something in there. And naturally, in this novel, it starts off as a single adventure with another adventure with some amazing characters. But I do want to ask, did you always plan to have Benjamin Shreve from The Witchway Tree to come back with a follow-up novel when you were writing The Witchway Tree?
You know, that's a really relevant question. I did not. I had no plan for that. And what happened was when I finished writing The Witchway Tree, I just missed Benjamin. I mean, I've had a lot of characters in my books and I've loved them all. I love the good ones. I love the evil ones. I love, because, you know, you're working with these people. You're spending your whole day with them. You know them. Every word they speak, you put into their mouths. And there's a certain intimacy that comes from that. But Benjamin, you know, I just adore. And so when I finished The Witchway Tree, you know, I didn't know what I was going to write next, but I just kept missing Benjamin. So that's when I started to think, well, what if Benjamin had another adventure? What if I, you know, aged him up a couple of years, which would be a little tricky. You got to make him a little bit savvier, a little bit wiser, a little bit better read, but still with the same sort of earnest kindness and dutiful attitude toward life. And I wanted to give him, you know, a first love. So now he's 19 instead of when he's narrating the story of The Witchway Tree, he's 17. So in The Matstone, he is 19. And, you know, he just is on another adventure. You don't have to have read The Witchway Tree at all to read The Matstone. They're completely independent stories. There are references to some things that happen in the Witchway Tree, but you don't have to know those things as you read. You learn them as you go along. So, I had no plan at that time to have another story with Benjamin.
Did you plan to have the privy be the catalyzing event to send him on his adventure? Because Dickie arrives in Comfort, Texas, which is about 100 miles from Austin, southwest of Austin, not a fictional town, a real town, is on that stagecoach, gets off, desperately needs to use the bathroom.
Yep.
And the sheriff is using the privy, knows that if you're coming off a stagecoach that you need to allow people who are coming off a stagecoach to get there, won't let them in. I love that. It's it's just funny. I mean, it's just absolutely funny. He has to use the bathroom, can't get it, goes elsewhere, gets into some verbal fisticuffs with the sheriff, ends up in jail. And then, of course, he misses his stagecoach, which has his bag. So were you looking to write humor from the very beginning?
Yes. I mean, well, no, I think what with Benjamin, when Benjamin, and Benjamin is funny, but it's because he doesn't know he's funny. He's simply relating in a very dutiful way what happened. But that sense of kind of a deadpan delivery that he has about these outrageous events makes it funny. And so, yeah, I mean, I've always wondered, okay, how did those, you know, with those privies, how did that work? I mean, probably the same as, you know, today you're waiting to get into a stall or you're waiting to get into, you know, a porta potty or whatever. And somebody's in there. And in this case, Dickie's extra frustrated because he knows it's a two-seater. It's a two-seater privy. And there's only one person in there.
Wait, there were two-seater privies?
Yes, there were two-seater privies. And the sheriff won't let him in. And, you know, so he's shouting and he starts cussing. He doesn't know it's the sheriff in there at the time. And he starts cussing. And Benjamin is across the street and he sees and hears all this. And he thinks, oh, the poor guy doesn't know he's, you know, he's shouting profanities at the sheriff and everything. And then, of course, the sheriff comes out. And Dickie has relieved himself right nearby, which the sheriff arrests him for indecent exposure and then for profanity and everything else he can chalk up to the situation and hauls him off to the jail. Meanwhile, this bag, which contains a mysterious treasure, because Dickie is a treasure hunter. That is what he lives for, is to find treasure, not to earn money. And, you know, at one point he does get some money for a reward and it's not satisfying to him because he didn't find it. And this mysterious treasure, which is in a small bag that's been left on the coach, has gone off and he is desperate to catch up with it. And he offers, you know, he tries to get Benjamin to take him to catch up because there are no horses to be let, as they used to say, which meant, you know, rented. That's how the story begins. Benjamin agrees to take him as far as Burney. But then they encounter the stagecoach has been held up along the way. And of course, Nell and her little boy are on it. So then he ends up with them
now,
as well.
Let's tell everyone who Nell is. Nell is ultimately the love interest. She's pregnant. She has a 4-year-old son. She's on the run.
She is on the run because there were these gangs in East Texas, and there were several of these gangs, just hideous people that basically were not ready for the Civil War to be over and certainly not ready for it to have ended the way it did. And so the federal government has sent in, you know, law enforcement to make sure that people abide by their laws and are fair to the freed people. And these gangs, this one is called the Swamp Fox Gang, basically.
By the way, real quick, this is a real life gang. I looked them up. You talk about it at the end of the book. This is a real life gang that was targeting Reconstruction agents, recently free Black people, anybody that was helping the free Blacks.
That's right. That's right. And they terrorized the towns. People were scared of them, scared to testify against them, knew what they were up to a large extent. If they were put in jail, they suddenly mysteriously found a way out. And because they were killing the agents of the Freedmen's Bureau, which was the federal government agents who were sent in to protect the freed Blacks. And so that's what was happening, and they were tormenting people. They were tormenting mostly, of course, the freed Black men and women and children. And so Nell is married to one of these people, and she has gradually become aware of what they're doing. And she, you know, she crosses that line very slowly because she's very scared of her husband. Her guilt has begun to really overwhelm her, and she feels that she has to tell where they're hiding. So she goes to the law. She goes to the Freedmen's Bureau representative who's there in that area, and she tells where the Swamp Fox gang is hid out. And then the law descends on them. Well, of course, they are furious. They figure out who's ratted on them, and they're after her. She has had to get out of town with her child. She knows the father is going to want the child back. She knows that she's in danger of retribution from them. And she's driven by, you know, her own sense of guilt, of, you know, wondering, when did I really know? When did I just suspect they were up to these horrible crimes? When did I know? Did I go to the law soon enough? Did I, you know, when did I cross that line from not knowing to being sure? And so she is in flight, you know, from these men, but also, you know, from her own sense of guilt.
One of the things I really appreciated about this novel is I think to some degree there's been more of a desire to mythologize the history of Texas, to focus only on the myths and what is seen as the positive aspects of Texas history. And what you have always done in your storytelling is to tell the good side and the bad side. You're not afraid to talk about the warts that are visible in Texas history. And you're a native Texan, lived in Nacogdoches, grew up in San Marcos. You lived in different places, Australia, Washington, D.C. But you've been pretty fearless in saying, I'm going to tell the Texas story, the whole story as I see it, not just this parts of the Texas stories that make us look good. Talk about your commitment to just telling the truth in these novels.
Well, the truth, for one thing, is a more interesting story because there's conflict there, and there's, you know, diversity. I mean, there's people from all different walks of life who came together to make Texas. And, you know, if you're just dealing with one side of the story, it's just not that interesting. And so I like really bringing in the different elements of the population, of the landscape, you know, just the every avenue of what's diverse, you know, in Texas. And to me, it's about storytelling. I mean, that is the most compelling, most fascinating, often the most horrifying story. And so that's, I think, you know, maybe selfishly, that's why I tell it, because I feel like not only does it need to be told, but it is also the best story. It makes for the most, you know, compelling narrative, but also sort of educational end of things. I mean, I didn't know about any of this stuff when I grew up and, you know, took seventh grade history courses, and I didn't know about what happened in Reconstruction era. And I kind of came across it simply because of when I dated the Witchway Tree in, you know, 1866, then, you know, we're following on into, you know, that's starting to be the beginning of Reconstruction era. But 1868, you know, you're well into it. And by moving it up those 2 years and, you know, moving a little, telling part of the story from this east part of Texas, which is where these gangs hit out, I was enlightened totally about some things that I had never known. And I just found it utterly fascinating. I think important story to tell.
So talk about doing the research about the Freedmen's Bureau and Reconstruction during that time period. Did you find yourself going down the proverbial well where you're saying, okay, I got to pull back. I'm so deep into this material. I can't include it all in the novel. Let me pull back and figure out what's most important to represent.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, all of it, you know, is, I mean, that's always the trick with history in general, when you're writing historical fiction, is that you have to know what to leave out, what to put in, what's important, what drives the story forward, rather than bogging it down, you know, you have to know, and it can all become incredibly interesting to you. I mean, historical fiction writers and historians in general, I think, are, you know, sort of excited by minutiae. You know, we get into those fine points, and we want to put it all in there. I mean, we've learned it. We find it really interesting. But what you have to figure out is, you know, does it move this plot forward? And does it inform the reader about the characters? I mean, does it have relevance to the story itself? And if not, you have to leave it out. So the trick is, when you find these interesting periods of history and elements of history that you want to deal with, you find, you know, the most powerful way you can to tell that story. And I felt that the way open to me was through Nell, and knowing, you know, how she had come to learn of these crimes, and then to feel, you know, the responsibility of being married to one of the perpetrators of these crimes. And how do you deal with that? I mean, he's abusive to her. He's threatening to her. if she tells, and she is terrified of losing her son. She's much more terrified of losing her son than she is of losing her life. And so she's walking that very fine line of, do I do the right thing? Do I go to the law? Do I report these crimes at the risk of losing my son? Because she knows if they take the son, they will raise him to be like them. They will teach him their own, you know, their own creed of life. And this, you know, she has this very sweet, shy, kind-hearted kid that she doesn't want to be brainwashed in that way. And that is her great fear. And that is why she is on the run and just trying to get out. And then, of course, you know, Benjamin, when he comes across her in this vulnerable situation, the stage she's on, where she's in flight, has been held up, and he ends up with her as a passenger, and the child as a passenger, and Dickie as a passenger. And then they end up at every stop along the way, they have to go further because he needs to, it turns out, you know, that she has no way, since she's been robbed, she doesn't have the means to get to Indianola, the coast city that she's trying to get to, the port city, so that she can get to New Orleans.
How do you craft the voices of these characters? I know I was at your the interview that Ms. Bird did with you, Sarah Bird did with you at Book People, and you talked about reading journals to help you to capture the voice of Benjamin Shreve. How did you capture the voice of Nell? How did you capture the voice of Dickie? Actually, let's talk about Dickie, because once again, that's the character. He loves to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Benjamin doesn't necessarily believe all the stories that he tells, but he's just such a fascinating character, being a treasure hunter. How did you capture his voice?
You know, I never know what the voice is. Voices come easily to me, which is surprising to me because foreign languages don't. But, you know, I can talk in the voice of this uneducated, you know, 19-year-old kid from the hill country of Texas. I can get Dickie down as well. You know, it's I don't know the answer to that, Hopeton. It's one of the things, you know, the plotting doesn't always come easy to me. There are a lot of things, you know, that don't come easy to me with writing, but dialogue for some reason just spills out. And so I have a good time with dialogue, and I had a really good time with Dickie because Dickie allowed me. So, you know, you talked about how, you know, you asked about, you know, what points to put in and different things. And there were so many interesting things I came across in the various things I read that didn't fit into the story. But Dickie, in his little paragraph here and there of his storytelling and his tendency to go on about things and to be, you know, excited and passionate about life, has a lot of stories to tell. And they involve these little incidents that I came across in my research that I couldn't fit into the story. So he will tell some wild tale, you know, that he's heard in his travels out west, or that he knows of, that happened out there, and or down in Mexico, you know, when he was searching treasure down there. And it allows me to get these little vignettes, these tiny little paragraph, you know, vignettes and details in that otherwise I had no avenue for.
Let's talk about Jorge Alvarez, who is a Black Seminole Indian, who is a critical part of the plot in helping Benjamin during a crisis period. I won't say what it's for. Don't want to reveal too much of the plot. Mm-hmm. And what I learned about that, I had heard stories about Seminole Indians and the Black community and how the Seminole Indians would take in Blacks. So you bring into the story this character out of Florida. I had never heard of the Negro Fort, by the way. So I found myself learning these different things about Black history I was unaware of through your writing. So how did you discover and decide to integrate this character and his backstory into the novel?
I wanted a character who himself was very diverse. So Jorge, you know, had been, there were, you know, a number of enslaved people who escaped from the South and went down to Florida and were taken in by the Seminole Indians. They were also enslaved by the Seminole Indians, but they were They had many more freedoms, and many of them intermarried with the Seminoles. And then Jorge is a grandchild of one of these people, and so he's of mixed race. And he then is part of. There were a lot of uprisings then, of course, from the Seminoles because they were being really terribly tormented by Andrew Jackson's troops and various other people trying to come in and take Florida. So eventually these people agreed to go to a reservation out west. They were promised all kinds of freedoms and great land and all of that. And they were promised that they would not be preyed on by slave hunters who basically were, you know, coming down, just taking anybody they saw who was black and taking them, even if they had never been, quote, owned by anybody up on those plantations, just taking them back and selling them into slavery. So this group of black Seminoles and Seminoles finally agreed to go to this reservation out west. Well, of course, they got out there and it was hideous conditions, horrible conditions, and they were preyed on. Many of them just taken and stolen. So they all decided, you know what, we're gonna go to Mexico. We heard there's some good deals for us in Mexico and some land that can be had. And so that's what they're going to do. So they packed up, this was several hundred people, and they hiked 900 miles. And they had to face, you know, so many dangers along the way. And sorry about my dog snoring. If you can hear him, he's very loud and he won't leave me. If I put him out, he'll howl at the door. But sorry. So anyway, they hiked 900 miles down to Mexico, and they worked for the Mexican government by protecting the border from the Comanches, mostly the Comanche were the indigenous people who were coming across that border. And kidnapping, you know, people from Mexico. So they were hired by the Mexican government to protect the border and also to protect it mainly from a lot of these, you know, white gangs of people that were coming down and committing crimes in the towns along the border in Mexico. And many of these guys were just people who were trying to escape the law in the United States. A lot of them had committed war crimes during the Civil War, and they were trying to evade, you know, the law. And so they were going down into Mexico and causing trouble down there. So basically, Jorge gets paid a bunch of money for every scalp he takes, and the Mexican government pays him. This is what many of the Black Seminoles did. They were known to be really, really great fighters. And they protected that border, and they were paid well by the Mexican government. But then at the end of the Civil War, they knew they could go back to the United States if they wanted to. And the U.S. Army said, basically, you know, these are really well-trained fighters, and maybe they'll come work for us and protect, you know, our forts and be scouts for us, basically, against, you know, the indigenous people that they were fighting in the West. And so they ended up, but Jorge at this point is old, and he doesn't believe that the conditions are going to be good, or that they're going to be paid as well as the U.S. Army says they're going to be paid, or they're going to be given the land that the U.S. Army said they were going to allow them to settle. He doesn't see that there's any guarantee. And so he decides he's just going to trek back as a free man across, you know, Texas and go in search of his sister, who had been separated from him during all of the disturbances and all of the battles and fights that took place in Florida. And so he's going to go find her.
And that was a pretty sad story. And so I couldn't help but notice a similarity between Jorge and Benjamin. Both were quiet, don't talk a lot, mm-hmm. let their actions do their speaking. And they both have sisters they're devoted to that they have made sacrifices for.
Yes.
So was that sort of an organic process of that parallel between those two characters?
Very organic. You asked the best questions and you phrased it the best way. That's what happened. I just realized that halfway through the book, I thought, wow, both of these guys have this situation, you know? And so it becomes a deep understanding and bond between Benjamin and Jorge.
So Indianola is a ghost town now.
Yes.
And it was at the point of this novel, 1868. Mm-hmm. It was the second biggest port in Texas behind Galveston. I think we all forget, I think the Port of Houston wasn't built until the early 1900s, actually. And the Port of Houston became the number one port after the hurricane that mm-hmm. destroyed Galveston in the early 1900s. So tell us some backstory of Indianola, because it ended up becoming a ghost town.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't, it's another one of these things where I didn't know a lot about Indianola when I started writing this book, but it is where most of the European immigrants came in through, the Germans that came in and settled in the hill country, the Polish, you know, most of those people came through Indianola, not Galveston. And it was a, I mean, it was a city, you know, when I started there, there's some really great books on Indianola. I mean, it was a thriving city and with a big population. And then it was hit by two successive hurricanes and essentially wiped out. And, you know, there were two hurricanes and then there was a fire, and that was the death knell, you know. And so it is now pretty much kind of underwater. You can see on the beach a marker where, you know, the downtown had been. And there's just nothing there. And it's, you know, it's a mysterious place for that reason, because, I mean, you know, you can see photographs of it and these busy streets and all this commerce and, you know, all this livestock that was brought in and out. I mean, they had, you know, a lot of cattle went out through there, and just a lot of people coming and going. And you know, you could catch a boat and go straight on to New Orleans there, catch a ship. And so it was, yeah, and it's just gone. I mean, there's nothing there. And then Galveston, of course, kind of had the same fate temporarily during the, I think it was 1901, 1903 hurricane in Galveston when it was really destroyed.
I know Benjamin Shreve was on your mind when you decided to write this novel. As you thought through the plot, did the characters start coming first, or did you start creating characters based on where you saw the plot going?
The second. It was that I knew that I wanted a love story. I didn't know exactly who Nell would be or what her name was or anything else. I had the idea of, you know, a journey. I mean, it's very much a trek across Texas, you know, from the hill country to the coast. And I love the idea of, you know, sort of found family is what people call it now, where, you know, where along the way, people who previously were strangers over a period of days, and in the Madstone, it's 10 days that they travel together, grow to share these amazing, you know, experiences and the violence that takes place, and, you know, the bonds that form between these people who are trying to survive together, and each of them with their own motive, you know, for why they are along on this journey and how they ended up together, and their own way of dealing with different problems, you know, but they come to care deeply about each other. And then, of course, you know, when there was a parting in those days, it was usually a permanent parting. I mean, because you couldn't become Facebook friends and keep up, you know, you were just saying goodbye. And so, you know, there's always in these stories that sense of loss, you know, of loss of people you've come to love, and you know, a kind of a bittersweet feeling. I mean, I don't like stories that just end with tragedy. And I don't like stories that seem so final in the end that you don't think about them afterwards. But when there's a sense of still thinking about it, you know, still worrying about these people, still wondering, you know, what their future lives might have been, I find that a very satisfying ending. And so, you know, I feel like I brought the story to a place where there's natural closure, and there's still emotional, you know, openness to the story. I don't know what your question was. I was just talking. I have no idea when we started with that.
I love the single person narrative, because for me, it just packs so much more of a powerful punch when you just have that one perspective. And you do such a good job of getting, even with the single person narrative, making us care so much about the characters that surround that Benjamin Shreve, caring so much about Nell, caring so much about Todd, loving his interaction with Dickie. I'm going to ask you, what's the secret? I guess it can't be a secret if you share, but there's just something that you do that just makes the reader care so much about these characters.
I mean, it may be because I really care about these characters. You know, I just really grow to fret over their lives, you know, and, but also, you know, Benjamin is a very loving person, and he's a non-judgmental person, which, you know, I try to be myself, in most situations. And, you know, where you really, you get to know people and you're trying to figure out, so where did they come from? Who are they? And not immediately to pass judgment on them, but to listen. You know, he's a good listener, and he's a good, he has a good analytical eye. And he doesn't immediately decide what's the deal with Dickie? Do I trust Dickie? Do I not trust Dickie? Who is Dickie? Why, you know, what is the treasure he's carrying? You know, he's savvy in that he drives a hard bargain with Dickie for the ride, you know? And so he's not a young man who's being taken advantage of, but he's not somebody that jumps to conclusions about people. And so it kind of keeps the story, it kind of keeps the reader also open to who these people are and interested and, you know, willing to find out rather than immediately revealing, you know, a judgment about this is a bad guy or this is a good guy or this, you know, this person has these flaws, so that you kind of get to know the characters as Benjamin gets to know them slowly. And I think for me as a reader, I always like that because it draws you along to find out, you know, you don't feel like you've been given a bunch of backstory about these people in the beginning and the story's sort of been front loaded with a bunch of backstory and then you're supposed to know them and then you're just supposed to hang out with them for a novel. No, you feel like you're getting to know them as you would get to know real people in your life. You know, if you're listening and you're open to who they are and what makes them do the things they do.
I love the slow burn of the relationship between Nell and Benjamin, that, you know, a lot of the things you read about today or you watch on television, the romance comes so quickly. It mm-hmm. burns so hot, so fast.
Yes.
And in this one, it's a slow burn. You're simmering. It's a crock pot romance.
I love that. Yeah, that's right. I mean, for one thing, you know, they are both, they're not forward people. Benjamin is very unsure of his, you know, situation with Nell. She's not someone who's, you know, going to declare her feelings right in the beginning. And so both of them are kind of, you know, really moving very incrementally toward allowing the person even to know how they feel. But you as a reader can really see it happening. And of course, you know, they're in these awkward situations. I mean, she's about to have a baby most of the journey. And she is, they're both very young, you know, and they are not boisterous, you know, talkative people. They, you know, and so there's just this growing, and Todd, the little boy, immediately gravitates to Benjamin and trusts him. And so that's one of the things that keeps pulling them together, you know, and keeps kind of making them feel like, wow, wouldn't we be a good family, you know? And so that is a lovely thing because Todd doesn't have all of the reservations or I don't mean reservations, but the sense of reserve and composure that they have. Todd just really loves Benjamin and wants to keeps, you know, crawling into the, you know, under the blanket with him when they're out, you know, in the wilds. I mean, of course they're sleeping under the wagon or in the wagon or wherever. And so, you know, it's very it's intimate in that they are having to navigate through these life situations out in, you know, the open air, essentially. But of course, you know, Dickie keeps warning Benjamin, you know, Dickie can see what's happening. And Dickie tells Benjamin, you know, that there's, you know, that some people will ride a horse around on, you know, on a ledge on the side of a cliff around a corner. And that ledge is getting narrower and narrower. And only when they go around the bend do they realize they can't turn around. The horse can't turn around on a really narrow ledge and can't back up on it safely. So he's warned Benjamin that you're out on that ledge. And Benjamin begins to fear he's already gone around that bend. And so, you know, you feel it happening from the warnings that Dickie keeps giving, and that Benjamin is going to, you know, that he feels Benjamin is going to get his heart broken.
Well, that's an interesting aphorism. How many of those aphorisms that you have your characters use, are those from family lore, grandma, grandpa, aunts and uncles?
Those are, a lot of those are from reading, you know, a lot of accounts of things in the Old West and things that happen. I mean, I just love to read, you know, research. I mean, it's you just read all of these firsthand accounts, journals and things. But also I grew up around horses. My grandparents had a place out in the hill country and we spent a lot of time out there. So there was livestock, and so we were around goats and chickens, and then, you know, we raised some chickens at our house in San Marcos when I was little. And so I was always very familiar with animals and did a lot of horseback riding. I had an old gelding that I rode after school every day through, you know, junior high and high school. And then a colt that my grandparents gave me. I was there out at their place when this colt was born, and it happened to be born on my birthday. And so they gave it to me when it was old enough to take back to San Marcos. It lived at Mr. Stewart's place. We just always called it Mr. Stewart's. He let us pay a little bit of money every month to keep the horse out there. And I worked with that horse every day to train the horse. So, you know, I did a lot of riding and just sort of, you know, bareback and not professional at all riding, just put the hackamore on and, you know, go for a spin. And, but through those things, I think you learn about the things that can happen, you know, and so some of it is from experience. I mean, there's like the flood in the Witchway Tree. I mean, I was very stupidly caught up in a flood once in San Marcos when I decided to cross a flooded creek that pulled me away because the road gave way underneath. I was trying to get to my horse and ended up in a tree and that sort of thing. So, you know, part of it is life experiences and part of it is, just reading.
Were there any characters as you were rewriting the novel, editing the novel, that you regretted having to cut out of the novel? Or were you able to keep in all the characters you wanted in there?
I was able to keep them all in this time. In my earlier books, I used to, you know, I just was too ambitious always. And the plot would get, you know, big. And then sometimes I would have to think, okay, you know, this is a little sprawling here and I need to go back. I need to get rid of, a separate plot line. I need to get rid of this other character. With the Witchway Tree and with this book, since there are very, very few characters, I just was able to put them in there when the story needed them. And so they would just happen along when they were needed in the story. And so there were no extraneous characters from the beginning that just started out. I mean, it's a very contained, journey. I mean, it's Benjamin, Dickie, and Nell and her son Todd, and then Jorge, and then it's the bad guys after them, and that's pretty much who you're dealing with for those 10 days of that journey.
Are there any characters that have captured your fascination so much that you're thinking already about using them in another novel?
Well, you know,
can I lobby? is I'm lobbying for Jorge and Dickie.
I know. I do. I do like them. You know, I mean, I do wonder, I have no idea what I'm writing next. And I, you know, several people have said, you know, can you make this three? You know, another story, you know, with Benjamin, I don't know. I mean, it'd be very hard to age him up a little bit more and have him retain the sense of earnestness and some naivety, you know, that he has and his language, you know, would have to mature a little bit. And I have so much fun writing in his language as I have it. So I don't know, but it would also be very interesting if, you know, he's writing this whole account to Tot, the child, to be read when Tot is 19 years old. And it would be very interesting for Tot at age 19 to read this and decide, you know, he needs to go find Benjamin and help Benjamin maybe look for his sister, whatever. Now, we know from the end of The Witchway Tree that Benjamin is an old man and still hasn't found his sister. So that idea would have to, you know, play out in a different way. But there are a lot of ways I could take it. And then I could also just do something totally different. You know, my other books are very, very different. Some are, you know, almost contemporary. The Monday was, you know, dealt with the shooting from the University of Texas Tower and, you know, in 1966. And so it is, you know, very different kind of story. All of the other ones are a different kind. None of them were told by first person narrators. So I could end up doing that, but there's nothing at this point that I feel certain I'm going to write next.
What is a madstone and can it cure rabies?
Okay. So the madstones, and I saw one for the first time on Thursday night at the Whitliff collections in San Marcos. I had never seen a real one. So these were, they're formed in various different ways in the stomach of like a ruminant animal. Any, like, mostly, you know, they're in cows, but if they are found in the stomach of a deer, particularly an albino deer, because they're very rare, they were considered to have the power to cure rabies, to draw the toxin out of a rabid animal's bite. And, you know, in studying, you know, this is one of these rabbit holes you asked about, going down the rabbit hole of what happened to people who contracted rabies and how they died. I mean, children, it was just, you know, they would be smothered between mattresses. I mean, people would tie themselves to trees and, you know, or have somebody shoot them. They, you know, because you were going to die. And so the only thing that you could hope for was something that gave you hope. And a madstone, you know, if you could find one, and they were very rare, many of them were brought over, that they'd been in families for generations, were brought over from Europe, and they were kept locked up and safe. The one that I saw in San Marcos at the Whitliff collections the other night had been in Frost National Bank for 40 years in a vault, because there was, you know, there'd been disagreement in the family about who it should belong to. Who it should have been passed to, various things like that. They were very, very coveted items because they gave you hope. And a lot of people believe they could draw toxins out of a snake bite and various other things, but they were called madstones because, you know, if you had rabies, you went mad, you know, and these were, that you would soak them in milk, usually was the protocol, and then you would apply them to the bite and hold it there. And if it seemed to kind of stick, it seemed like it was drawing out the toxins. And then they said, if you put it back in the milk, sometimes it would turn a very pale kind of greenish color, which meant the toxins had been drawn out. And so there were just enough times when the bite wasn't actually from a rabid animal, you know, like maybe just some vicious dog bit somebody and he wasn't rabid. Then the stone seemed to have worked. Or if the bite hadn't penetrated deeply enough for the toxins to get in there, then the stone seemed to have worked. So there were enough times that it appeared to work that people, you know, continued to believe in this for centuries, largely because there was nothing else to believe in.
At what point in writing the novel did you decide that the madstone was going to be a key part of the novel?
Along the way, I didn't have it in mind. I certainly didn't have the title in mind. The way I write is not the most efficient way to write, and not certainly not the quickest, but I just go along for the journey and see what happens on the way. I mean, I didn't think of Jorge in the beginning. I didn't think of the Madstone. Dickie comes in at the beginning, so I thought of him, and I knew there was going to be a love interest. I didn't know who she would be. I didn't think of the Swamp Fox gang. So all those things came up as I started the story, and then I would read, and then, oh, something needs to happen. So who is this woman? What is her past? What is she in flight from? And then I learn about the Swamp Fox gang. And then, you know, things happen along the way. And, you know, you need a dramatic moment right there. Something has to turn the tide. And so, you know, you start digging around. Oh, well, maybe a rabid animal, maybe, you know. And so then you go there. So I live this story as my characters live this story. I don't often, you know, often I really don't know what's going to happen next. So there's a sense of panic at the end of the chapter, you know, it's like, okay, so what are they going to do? But by then, what you hope is that you've come to know your characters well enough that you know, okay, these people, if you put them in this situation that I've put them in right now, what are they going to do next? What are they going to say next? What can happen that they can authentically respond to next? And then the story grows from there. So I can't really imagine writing a story with a plot line from the beginning. It doesn't sound very interesting to me when you're just filling in the dots and you know, going step by step. It certainly isn't, you know, as organic. But the thing about it is, I would not have the imagination to come up with a story without seeing it unfold. So by waiting to see what happens and kind of letting the characters then guide you as you place them in different situations, you end up going places with the story that you would not have thought of or that you didn't even know existed. And so it's often, you know, sometimes you go down these wrong roads and have to turn back, but often, you know, it leads you into a whole part of the story that you had no idea you were going to write when you started.
How much do the characters accompany you all day when you're not writing? Are the characters always there in the back of your mind? Do you take a nap and you dream about a character? Is it just sort of with you a whole lot beyond just sitting down and writing?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I mean, it can be a little of a problem, you know, when you need to be focusing on other things. They're always there. I mean, I've learned to jump pretty quickly out of, you know, my writing into, you know, a phone call that comes through or, you know, somebody's at the door or whatever it is. Because, you know, nobody has total control over their life unless you want to really seal yourself off for, you know, hours a day. And I have kids, grown kids now, but, you know, you still have this other life, you know, this real life that you're living, as well as this fictional journey that you're on. And so I just try to be very flexible. And plus, I don't have the attention span to say, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to work for 3 hours, no interruption. I mean, I would be like 20 minutes later, oh, who can I call? You know, I haven't talked to Steve today, or I haven't talked, you know. And so I just am in and out of all of it, you know, with the characters in my mind, and at the same time, you know, my family in my mind, and, you know, just kind of back and forth between what is most pressing at the moment. And I don't have a certain, you know, designated work time. I'm not a morning person at all, but I often work at night. And I work during the day. If I don't have anything else I am slated to do that day, then I can work many hours during the day, off and on. But if I do, then I just put it aside till the next day.
Elizabeth Crook, author of The Madstone. It's a fabulous novel. Once again, you got me again, Elizabeth. You got me again.
You should see the smile on my face. I was hoping you would like this one, too.
Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me. Always. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHey.